Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee are two of the winners of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics. The Nobel Committee cited their experimental approach to alleviating global poverty as reasons for awarding them the prize. And over the past several years, the two scholars have watched as the woes of poverty metastasized beyond typical income brackets. Populism swept across nations, the psychedelic madness of Brexit, as they call it, strutting dictators or their elected equivalents, exploding inequality, environmental catastrophes, global policy disasters. Duflo and Banerjee insist on asking what role their profession, what role economists have played in these myriad miseries. In their new book, they look to where economic policy has failed, where ideology has blinded us, but they also say a different kind of economics can be useful in today's world. So this hour on Point, Nobel Prize winners on good economics for hard times. And joining me in the studio are Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo. As I mentioned, they are two of the awardees of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics. Esther Duflo, by the way, is the second woman ever to win the prize. They are both professors at MIT. Abhijit Banerjee is a professor of economics, and Esther Duflo, a professor of poverty alleviation and development economics. Their new book is titled Good Economics for Hard Times, and I have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Professors, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And congratulations, by the way, to both of you on winning the Nobel Prize this year. Let me just first start right where you begin your book. What is it, or what role do you see economists as having played in this sort of surge of global challenges that we've seen over the past decade? And Professor Duflo, I'll start with you.
So maybe less of an sort of active role and more of a passive role, in a sense, in as a profession, letting the stage to talk about economics to people who either were representative of specific interest, like, for example, you know, chief economist of some banks, or people who came at it with a reasonably strong ideology. Mm. And not really economists as a profession is actually much more diverse and much more, much less ideological than you might think. But we have let these voices be a little bit silent. And the economics that had permeated both in the media and in policymaking was kind of unidimensional and not that useful.
Okay, so TV economists, point taken. But about the economists that have been influential in policymaking, because that is literally where the rubber meets the road, right? Where policy has an impact on human lives. Are you saying that they've come from sort of a narrow slice of the economic profession?
Well, I think there's some of it just time. I mean, there's a generation of economists from the University of Chicago who were extraordinarily influential and who had, I would say, mostly misleading or even worse than misleading views on many things, and that they had enormous effect on how policy was made. And it sort of created the common sense of even outside economics, in a sense of even of liberal discourses, are often dominated by ideas like, you know, but if we try to help these people, they're going to all become lazy or things like that. These are fed in from a particular angle. They had enormous influence. They were particularly, I think, perverse in their effects on policy. and we have a hard time getting out of them.
So can I ask both of you, I mean, you have for years have been working in the trenches in the study of poverty economics, right? About the actual lives of people living in poverty and what successful policies are to change those circumstances. How did it make you feel as scholars in this field to see how certain orthodoxies in economics really did take hold in policymaking? I mean, you're mentioning the Milton Friedman School of Economics here, right? And to the point where, I mean, in the 90s or 2000s, it was almost impossible to say in the public sphere, whether a politician or someone in the media, that there are other models that might work without being sort of laughed off the stage. I mean, how, as you were watching that, what were you thinking?
Yes, in working in development economics and working with policymakers, we tend to work, you know, with the second layer of policymakers who are trying to implement things. And at some level, at that level, the ideology is maybe a little less prominent, especially if they're willing to work with us, because someone who is very committed to a particular ideology is usually not very willing to participate in an experiment to try something else or evaluate their main ideas. So the people we worked with have always been quite you know, pragmatic into solving issues like immunization or education or things like that. And when we started writing this book and started kind of reflecting on the way that policymaking has gone in the U.S., or frankly, in France, it's not that different. It's the other country I know well. We, I think, were surprised, at least I was surprised, perhaps because I was not watching, you know, not I didn't have my eye on it earlier, by how much a sort of very simple-minded view of how people behave and therefore the dangers of doing some kind of social policies, how widespread these views have gone in policymaking. And in a sense, the economic profession has left the policymakers behind with the ideology that used to be ours maybe some decades before.
Well, because some of these orthodoxies, including the superiority of capital, the unassailability of markets, you know, the drive for efficiency above all, the presumption that people will always exclusively act in their own self-interest. I mean, these are things that are so deeply baked into economic policy still, I would argue, in the United States, that they seem rather hard to unwind. I mean, how wrong or how distant from reality do you see some of those sort of dominant assumptions, Professor Banerjee?
Well, I think probably I think one could go down that list and find ways to, I think, throw every one of those out. But I think the one that seems to me to be most egregious is this view that people essentially think of financial self-interest. So self-interest is a kind of a broader umbrella, and many things are self-interest, including, you know, wanting to spend time with your children. But I think financial self-interest is so dominant in the way economists look at things. And I think that has been the framing assumption of so many of the policy pushes that have happened. And I think that's critical. So I would say that the one I want to take issue with immediately is that one.
Okay.
I mean, one could also take issue with the fact that markets usually work, or that welfare is GDP. You know, all of these are kind of extraordinary assumptions to make. And economists kind of talk about why those assumptions, under what conditions those assumptions may be legitimate, but then they kind of forget all that, and we talk as if GDP is welfare.
Right. I have to say that I appreciate very much watching both of you think through how to respectfully take the Milton Friedman School of Economics down a couple of pegs here. But so let's talk about this, the motivation for of how people act in their own self-interest. So you're saying that that is not actually, or that the way self-interest has been defined has been too narrow. Can you explain more about that?
Yeah. So the self-interest, of course, in a sense, we all act in our self-interest, but the way that economists operationalize that, and this has very much percolated in the policy sphere, is purely financial self-interest. So that manifests itself in several ways. For example, if you are a rich person and, you know, the marginal tax increase in the top bracket, then you're going to work less, or you're not going to invent the new Microsoft because you now have less incentive to do so. So that's one. The other one at the other end of the spectrum is that if you're a poor person and I'm now giving you a guaranteed income, then it's not anymore necessary for you to work very hard, so you're going to stop working. So we should have programs like the earned income tax credit, which reward work, which means that if you work, then you will get you a little more. So that's a program that's very much inspired by this idea of that people respond to financial incentive.
Okay, so tell us then more about what your actual research has shown about how people do respond. Because I guess what you're saying is you have found multiple times over that people don't want to stop working. They generally don't stop working when they're given additional assistance, regardless of what policymakers might think.
So, I mean, one thing very important to say is that this book is often built of research of other people.
Okay.
It's a kind of an attempt to synthesize what I think is the kind of the, in some ways, the odd secret of economics, which is that we actually know that most of these things are not true. We kind of agree that they're not true, but we don't actually go out and say it. And so I think this is an attempt to actually go out and say it.
Yeah.
So,
but if I just may, by economists not saying these things, it's come at a terrible cost to many people.
Yes,
right?
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of, it's not easy to say it exactly for the reason you raised, which is that it will raise the hackles of many orthodoxies. And so, you know, you might as well do your research, stay quiet about it, hope somebody else writes about it. So that's a bit what's what the task that we took upon ourselves. But having said that, this I have a paper which is called "The Myth of the Lazy Welfare Recipient," and the point of that paper was that we actually studied a bunch of cases across the world where people were given unconditional cash transfers, basically given money, free money. Did they stop working? And the precise answer in that, and we can do it pretty precisely, is that none of that happened. No one stopped working because they were getting free money.
Well, we are talking this hour with Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee. They are two of the winners of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics. Their new book is Good Economics for Hard Times. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee. They are two of the winners of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics. They won the prize along with Michael Kremer. And they are co-authors of the new book, Good Economics for Hard times. And so, Professor Duflo and Professor Banerjee, let's talk specifically about one of the areas that you cover in your books, in your book about how to look at it differently. Migration probably is one of the most pressing. First of all, let me ask you, what is it that we get wrong right now about our understanding of the major drivers of migration?
So on the, we get two things completely wrong on migration, typically. One is precisely on the driver, and that's related to this idea that people do not act in their immediate financial self-interest. So we think that if there was not very strong barriers to migration, say a big wall, for example, mm-hmm. on the southern border, not that anybody has made such suggestions, then people would immediately flood us. Because the wages and incomes are so much higher here than they are, say, in Latin America, that if it was only possible, everybody would want to come here.
Right. The people just follow a gradient of wages, essentially.
Exactly. So, and that is actually wrong. That's wrong for international migration, because factually, when you're looking at the migration flows, they are quite low. And that is one way to understand why it is wrong, is to just look also at internal migration, where there are no such barriers. And we can see that people just, you know, don't move really in very large numbers from rural areas to the towns in developing countries, from cities and towns affected by trade shocks in the U.S. to other cities and towns where there might be jobs. From Greece in the middle of the financial crisis in Greece to other countries in Europe where they would be absolutely welcome. So people do not move even when there are no barriers to do so and where you would think that there are strong financial incentives.
Okay, so when we actually look at the facts, you're saying that people don't move as much as we might expect them to. But let me just back up here a moment, because you said that right now migration is actually lower than it has been historically. Is that what you're saying? Or because you said it's quite low.
Within the U.S., it's lower. U.S., basically, if you take from 1950 to now, the fraction of people moving in every year from this county to the next has, I think, almost halved.
Okay.
So the U.S. is much less mobile now than it used to be
internally. But international migration, though?
It's about stable. From the late 60s to now, the fraction of international migrants is roughly the same as it was. It's roughly the same between now and 1970.
I see.
With the exception of some peaks, like, you know, at the height of the Syrian refugee crisis. But I think the perception remains that, oh, we must still be at the level of migration that we experienced during that crisis, when in fact it was really, it ebbs and flow over a basis that's almost.
Okay. Okay, I see. So then you're also saying that, therefore you're saying that people aren't necessarily just exclusively moving for better wages, as much as one might expect.
Yeah. So what really pushes, there are kind of two kind of people who move. People who are either super entrepreneurial, and then maybe they move to make a better life. But you really would want these people in your country, because they are the ones who are going to become the entrepreneurs of tomorrow. Or people move when they are pushed by something, by
conflict,
you know, desperation, conflict, etc.
Okay. So let me ask you then, in terms of why people move, there are some truths that may fly in the face of what we hear politicians say. But what about the effect that migration has on labor markets? I mean, you talk about that specifically in the book, that there's a presumption that it has a negative effect on domestic workers. Is that the case?
For low-skilled domestic workers, there is no evidence that wages go down when there's a large influx of similar low-skilled migrants from elsewhere. And this has been studied by many people, not us, but many other people, done very carefully, lots of debates. But I think the burden of that evidence is very clear, and it's that there's really no demonstrable effect on wages.
Okay. So let's stick with this for a moment because, you know, the best data set I have is not a reliable one because it's anecdotal. But frequently on this program, when we talk about immigration, we have people call in, right, from all over the country. Let's take the construction industry, for example. And these are people who I believe them when they say I've been working in the construction industry for 30 years and it's been difficult for me to get work in the past 15 years because of the number of undocumented immigrants who are coming and taking low-wage construction jobs. So there seems to be a disconnect between the individual impact that many people, well, sticking with the United States, that many Americans are feeling versus what you're saying the sort of macro-level numbers say. So
the question is, what would happen if these undocumented migrants were not there? And it would not be necessarily be the case that the person who is now feels that they are replaced by a undocumented migrant would get their job back. So in fact, there is many other things that firm could do instead of hiring the native workers. For example, they could decide to mechanize, or they could decide to not build some projects, or they could decide to do any number of things. So in fact, in the 60s, there was very much a kind of popular demand for kicking out migrants from work who were working in farms. Mm. And the idea was that they were taking away the job from the native worker. Those were the braceros. And at some point, Kennedy kind of gave to pressure, and the braceros were sent home, and their visas got revoked. And we can look at what happened before and after to the employment and the wages of agricultural workers in California compared to other similar places, and the answer is nothing happened. Their wages, their employment didn't pick up. And one of the reasons is that the company that were the farmers, big farm that were employing the braceros, moved to to crop that could be mechanized easily. And mechanized within there. So that's
I mean, I think one of the issues which makes, I think, migrant workers attractive to employers is precisely the fact that they're self-selected. They're often sort of living on very little. They're planning to maybe build a life. They work very, very hard for very, very little. And when you get rid of them, you don't necessarily want somebody else. You just want no one. You'd rather mechanize. So I think the idea that these migrants are all like, you know, exactly like everybody else is also misleading, because I think a lot of them are extremely motivated people. They come at huge personal cost to do it. They're not necessarily going to just be just like everybody else. So the employers actually are often particularly happy to have them. And then when they go away, they rather just do without them.
Okay. Now, you have a couple of other examples about sort of more localized ways of looking at what the effect of sort of a surge of migration has had. You reference work done around the Mariel boat lift, for example. Can you remind us, how much did the influx of migrants at that time, how much did it change the local labor market? What impact did it actually have?
So this is a landmark study by David Kahn. Which studied the arrival of tens of thousands of Cuban refugees in a very short period of time when Castro kind of gave them a green light to leave. And he compared what happened in Miami mm-hmm. Compared to similar towns, you know, before and after the arrival of the Mariel boat lift refugees. And he found nothing. No effect on wages or employment. And this was kind of this came a little bit as a landmine. It was very, very surprising, I think, these results in the economics profession, because people kind of assumed that there should be an effect, at least on some people. And it was put under tons of scrutiny. And number one, it kind of held up to scrutiny quite well. And number two, it was replicated by similar unusual big wave of migrants in other contexts, in The people coming back to France after the end of the Algerian War is another example. The wave of people going moving within Europe during the Balkans War, etc.
So then, how, given the information that you just shared with us, we still, nevertheless, in many nations right now, many European nations, the United States, et cetera, we see deep concerns over the level of migration. And perhaps the challenge is I keep thinking of sort of like local level impacts versus what the macro numbers say. But there does seem to be a sense in multiple countries that this is a problem, that migration is a problem. I mean, what does, you know, the research that you've done in poverty economics tell you about what would you tell political leaders about how they should be looking at migration or all the people who do call in and say, no, I lost my job because of an immigrant?
I mean, the message is a bit hard to deliver, because the message is actually that, you know, it's actually very hard to know causality. Part of the reason why we have spent our lives doing randomized controlled trials is because assigning causality is a huge pain. And the example Esther just gave, which is the braceros, is exactly that, which is that, you know, you think that you would have had that job if these people weren't there. But in fact, the employers didn't want you. They wanted machines instead of you. How would you see that? You wouldn't see that. You'll just see that, you know, these guys are there. I don't have a job. You don't think the counterfactual, which is that if these guys were not there, maybe there would be large-scale mechanization, and therefore the jobs won't be there. So I think this is the reason why one of the goals of our book was to restore the faith in our competence as a profession, which may be a long shot, but nonetheless, it's one that exactly is in points like this where looking carefully at the data and thinking hard about why the obvious intuitions are not always correct is critical, and that's sort of why we wrote the book.
So then this leads us straight back to something you were saying earlier, and I'd love to explore more with you about how should we look upon what self-interest actually is, and just sticking with the example of migration within the United States, right? Because as you said, the presumption is in towns or cities where major industries vanish and there's large-scale unemployment, the presumption, the simple economic presumption, is that people would move to a place where there are jobs. And yet, as you say, we haven't seen that as much as we have in past U.S. history. How then should we define or reassess what self-interest actually is? Because this is where you bring in the concept of sort of less tangible things than income, about dignity, about community. How should we look at that?
Yeah, there are two things that we argue should be taken into account, and maybe other people will find other things, but two things that seem to really come from the research. One is the deep need to belong to a community, to have a part in a social network. And the fact is, when you live in your town and you've always lived there, you have your extended family, all your network of friends. Among other things, they provide childcare, but they also provide a sense of who you are. And there is a deep epidemic of loneliness in this country, and people do not want to be, you know, victim of that epidemic. Loneliness actually makes people sick, to some extent can lead to depression, and sometimes literally kills them. Mm-hmm. So that is one, which I think needs to be, what we argue, needs to be taken into account as something as profound or more profound than the need to make a living. The second one is this notion of dignity that you talked about, and it's the need for every individual to feel that their life has a purpose. And, you know, a little bit of introspection would suggest that that's kind of not outlandish as a claim, that you want your life to have a purpose, and typically, given the amount of hours that we spent working in all of the surveys or the polls, the way that what people want from their job is a sense that there is a purpose attached to these jobs. And it turns out that, of course, the people who are more educated and are making more money also are more likely to report that they find a sense of purpose from their jobs. But so do people who have been working for a very long time on the same job. Say, you know, take an industry making furniture somewhere in North Carolina, and people have grown through the ranks and become, you know, skilled cabinet makers and foremen or something like that. They do derive a sense of dignity from that work. They do derive a sense of purpose. And suppose that job vanishes, then you don't get your dignity back with a job as a janitor or a security guard in furniture shops 200 kilometers away, or, you know, driving a truck for, you know, yeah, UPS delivering the same furniture. So we argue that this has to be taken into account in our, you know, understanding of how people behave in response to shocks, and also how we need to compensate them. How society needs to be organized to deal with those shocks.
So that is what I'm very eager to understand more from both of you, because ultimately, to put it rather simply, when policies are put in place, the process of getting there involves lots of numbers. It involves creating, you know, frameworks around the policy. How do we quantify what dignity is in terms of making policy? How do we quantify what loss of community is?
I suspect that I think there might be more creative people than us. I wouldn't say that we're going to be able to do that. But I do think what is important.
You just won the Nobel Prize.
This is true, but I'm sure somebody will eventually have a good answer to the question. I don't. I'll continue, however. I think what is important here is simply the fact that in the calculus, a job lost here and a job created 200 miles away are equated. And that by itself is already a problem. The fact that the loss of the job is not treated as something more than, okay, this one person lost a job here, one person gained a job there. And that particular kind of equation, that's where I think we should start worrying. We should start worrying that every loss of a job is loss of something more than a job.
Well, we are talking this hour with Professors Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo. They are two of the winners of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Professors Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee. They are two of the winners of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics. They're both professors at MIT, and they're co-authors of the new book, Good Economics for Hard times. And Professors Duflo and Banerjee, we've been talking a lot about migration and about changes in the labor market. We were focused a little on what happens to low-income workers. But in your book, you also talk about what happens to middle and higher-income workers when there's lots of migration. Is the effect the same? Is there no effect?
No. In fact, there are less studies on this, but the studies suggest that actually for those people, there is an effect, and it's a negative effect. So in other words, the high-skilled workers that President Trump is keen to attract, they are the ones who hurt other workers. So if you get a lot of electricians, electrician earnings do go down.
Okay. So in that case, people are feeling an effect. All right. So let's talk. But, you know, we were starting to get to what might the policy prescriptions be to help people through these. I think these are rather cataclysmic changes that we're dealing with. People's feelings about migration or the impact that it's having, income inequality, the environmental challenges, climate change. These are not small problems. And you make the case that that economists actually have a very positive role to play. So Professor Duflo, I mean, what would be one of your the powerful policy prescriptions you might put out that we haven't done before?
Well, one of the ideas we put forward is related to this idea that people do not move and that people care about many more things than just the money in their job. They also care about the social network and dignity. And that has the consequences that when a shock hits their town, if people are less likely to move, the shock is going to hit a lot of people also because the industries tend to be clusters. So a town is entirely made, say, of furniture makers. So they all suffer together and they don't go. The income goes down. They stop buying food. So the price of the McDonald's, the wages of the McDonald's worker goes down. Finally, the McDonald's goes and the entire town goes into a tailspin. And we have... So that creates individual suffering for individual people or community suffering for communities, as opposed to the way that we've been thinking about in policy that on average, there might be some cost for the low-income workers, and therefore there should be general program that helps everyone. But it's not the way that the costs actually work. The costs are on specific people.
Right.
So I think we need to have policies that are much more targeted on specific people. One of them we actually already have is called the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program, but it's tiny. It's miniature. It's actually been evaluated by someone called Ben Himmen, which was in a very nice program that, because it is so tiny that it's completely random if you get it or not get it. It really depends on the generosity of the officer in front of you. You compare people who are lucky enough to get it, and for years they make more money and they get jobs faster and they get better jobs and they kind of get on their feet much easier. So why wouldn't we take the trade adjustment program and make it much wider in terms of coverage, much more generous, maybe modeled across the maybe modeled after the GI Bill in terms of its generosity. And also I think, and that's kind of the overarching theme we have here, is change the rhetoric around it.
Yeah.
Not treat it that this is welfare, this is for the losers who are not managing to pick themselves up by the bootstrap and go get a better life and live the American dream, but saying you are like the heroes of our society. You are the person who is paying in your individual life the cost for shocks that the entire society is at some level benefiting from. And therefore, we are going to treat you as a hero, as a veteran, and we are going to give you the same benefit that you would have if you had been a veteran to a war. And I think both in terms of the actual money to be spent, but equally importantly, the rhetoric around it, it would help, I think, counter some of the nationalistic, xenophobic imagery, which has been to tell people, no, you're not losers, you're victims of wars that are waged by Mexicans or by Chinese or by the elite. And have given in some perverse way some measure of dignity from people from whom it's been robbed forever. So I kind of, we think it is, we need to go back to, to that and saying, well, yes, indeed, you are like a hero for us. And we are going to help you in the way that we help our heroes.
I mean, to be fair, President Trump ran a campaign talking about trying to stand up for the forgotten people of America. You know, his inaugural address talked about American carnage in cities and towns that had been laid waste by a form of economic warfare. I suppose what I'm hearing you saying is that the policies then didn't follow.
Correct. But I think we have to – image was powerful, is powerful, and unless someone else – with reasonable politics, takes it over and acts on it, then it's going to continue to be a winning image.
Did you want to say something, Professor Banerjee?
I was just going to say that there's a sense in which I think that that also comes with President Trump is also very happy to use the word loser for almost everybody who he doesn't approve of. So I do think that this conversation really needs to be taken a step up from the abstract sense of war to you are just because you have lost your job doesn't mean you're a loser. I think that particular recognition is still not anywhere in the welfare system.
Hmm. Well, so I want to talk about the opposite end of the income spectrum. Because, as you know, in the process of the Democratic primaries, we've been hearing a lot of discussion about the role that the ultra-wealthy should play in correcting the ravages of income inequality. I mean, given your research and your call to have economics take this broader view, including about human dignity, about community, about, I suppose, fundamental equality, do you believe the idea of a wealth tax is a good one?
I think it's a great one. I don't see a reason. I think the arguments that I'm hearing against it are mostly arguments which sort of play this sort of it's too difficult to implement, so we should do something else. And I think that that's just that's the excuse we've been used for year after year after year. In fact, I think we know much better how to implement it in a country like the U.S., where people are very unlikely to take off and, you know, move to somewhere else, I think it's not that hard to do. I haven't seen a single argument that convinces me that this is really as impractical as been implied by so many of the critics of the idea.
But don't you say that you don't think it's actually going to raise that much revenue?
Correct. But I think fighting that the reason it won't raise that much revenue is that I think a lot of those people who would have been in that tax bracket will hopefully not be there. And so we'll have solved the problem of inequality, which is why it won't raise a lot of revenue. So that's part of the reason. Part of the reason is also just in the end, there's a lot of the income of the economy still with normal people, and therefore, if you really want to raise revenue, you'll also have to go to them. But I think the first order fact is that you can clobber inequality, I think, if you really went hard on those taxes.
Okay, so tell me more about that, because you do write about how you think that the ultra wealthy need to recognize that it's a form of self-interest to correct for too much income inequality. And you know, in a sense, we've been seeing that. It was several months ago that I interviewed Ray Dalio, right, giant in the investment world. He's been talking a lot about the dangers of inequality. But beyond a wealth tax, I mean, what would you do?
Well, to some extent, the increase in inequality in the U.S., the increase in inequality in the U.S. and the U.K. was stratospheric, starting, from the Reagan era until today, and have been less stratospheric in Europe. So it, unfortunately, that's like not a very big sample to look at all the difference that took place in the U.K. and Europe, but some very different policy choices were made by the Reagan administration, Thatcher administration, than what was made in the rest of continental Europe. So taxes is one of them. It's not just the tax, the wealth tax, but also the top marginal tax. A great value of a very high top marginal tax for the very, very, on income, not on wealth, for the very, very rich people, is that there is no need for the firms to pay their CEO stratospheric amounts of wages if 90% of this money or the top of this money is going to the government anyways. So the just the fact of having those taxes would eliminate eventually those wages, because the company would say, well, no, there's no point paying you that much money. I'm just going to, you know, give you, reward you in some other in some other ways. Other things were done, you know, the, on the other end that also play a role, like minimum wage and not raising it or low, not raising it in, on par with the rest of the economy, the reform, the welfare reform, which was dreamt by Reagan, done by
Clinton,
played a big role as well. So all of these things, you know, need to be done. I'll add to one thing on the wealth tax. First of all, when we wrote the book, what was proposed was lower than what is proposed now.
I see.
So the current version that is proposed in the Warren plan would actually raise more money than the initial plan, which had a, which was only going to 2 or 3%. The second thing is that even if it doesn't raise that much money to start with, for example, even if whoever is elected could only do the modest version of it, it would you could take this money, raise it, which is, it's the wealth tax is popular. The idea of having a wealth tax is popular. The idea of raising the top marginal tax is popular. So that's something you could do. In principle, minus some political
minus all the
issues.
Political hurdles, but, yes.
But at least you would have the people behind you. That would, then that would generate some money if you could use this money with a purpose, not just, we, that would make it very clear how this money is being used.
That's right.
To help those who are suffering, the bottom 50% of the distribution, then you might increase the legitimacy in government action in general, which would, you know, possibly create a virtuous circle where there would be more agreement of on to what is our duty as society, what type of revenues we need to raise to discharge his duty.
Right. So clearly earmark it, and rather than just sort of dumping it into the federal government's general fund.
At least link it, you know.
Yeah. Well, so let me ask you though, as I read through your book, one thing that I wondered is that I don't read you, either of you, ever saying that or looking for models or ideas outside of capitalism. That it still seems to be sort of the framework within which, you know, these ideas are dwelling in. I have a lot of people calling in and telling me capitalism is the problem and that's what we need to dump.
Well, I think that the experience of a really different economic system hasn't been great. So far, I have no particular brief for capitalism. I would say that if somebody proposed something that I thought had a plausible chance of working and we experimented with it and did small experiments where we could see if it's a little bit how dysfunctional it is. I would be all for it in a sense. I don't have any, but I do think that right now, I think talking about very different things in a sense paralyzes us, because I think the call for action right now is for doing something that will work now. And if I go out with the message that, well, we first have to radically transform all our institutions, well, that's a tall order and one that probably won't happen immediately. And then we're going to deepen the problem we are in. So I want to be in a place to act.
Fair enough. By the way, I just wanted to, as a very unrelated aside, you mentioned Charles Dickens' Hard Times in your book, one of my favorite books, when he talks about the mad melancholy, how the machines of the Industrial Revolution resembled mad melancholy elephants. It's one of my favorite books, so I just wanted to give a nod to Mr. Dickens here. But we have a minute and a half left. You do try to communicate in your book that there's reason to have hope. Hope in economics, hope for solutions. What What hope is there?
Hope for solutions, in the sense that the advantage of us not trying to uphold capitalism, what we are trying to see is that within the framework of capitalism, there is so much you can do. And the bills of goods that have been sold to people is that, oh, you cannot have capitalism without super low taxes and a punishing welfare system, because otherwise the whole thing would grind to a halt. What we are trying to explain is that actually that's not true. Having a wealth tax, having very high marginal income tax for the highest income, having a generous support system would not upend capitalism. It would actually, it would not register on economic growth. It would, and everybody would live better lives. So there is plenty of scope for solution, at least within economics. So the problem becomes politics. And we are hoping that with this book, we can at least start a conversation so that the politics kind of can follow a little bit where we think the economics is.
Well, Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee are two of the winners of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics. They won along with Michael Kremer. They're both professors at MIT, and their new book is Good Economics for Hard Times. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Professor Duflo and Professor Banerjee, congratulations once again, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation, and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.